I'm Sam Post, and welcome to The Music Post, where each week we get to know some music and explore it with some listening, commentary, and demonstrations. Today we have a very special guest, my colleague, pianist, and harpsichordist, Ralitza Placheva, with whom I'll be performing The Art of Fugue in about a week. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Now, today we'll be learning more about The Art of Fugue, and we move on from the first four fugues, which are the so-called simple fugues, into the realm of the counterfugues, numbers 5 through 7, and especially we'll be talking about Contrapuntus 6. And we're going to hear it not only on the piano later in the show, but first on the harpsichord. So Ralitza will play it for us on the harpsichord before we get into more detail about this particular fugue. Beautiful, beautiful playing Thank you, Ralitza. You really make the harpsichord sing, and I can tell the listeners from personal experience that is extremely difficult, something that I have not been able to achieve playing that instrument, and we'll get back to that a little more later when we talk about the choice of harpsichord versus piano. Now, in case you missed episodes 1 and 2, I encourage you to go back and listen to those. But for those who did miss it, here is the main theme to the Art of Fugue, which inspires all the pieces. So, Ralitza, will you play that for us? And now, why don't you play for us the bass voice at the beginning of Contrapuntus 6. Very similar, but also there are some differences from the main theme.
Yes, the differences are, one, there are some new notes in the picture, and those notes are filling in the gaps between the skipping notes in the original theme. And then we are also hearing a dotted rhythm, which means that some notes are longer than others, and correspondingly other notes are shorter. So we
especially at the end, you heard the da-dan, da-dan.
It got faster at the end, exactly. And this becomes a gesture that is going to be used throughout the whole fugue.
We'll get back to that a little later as well. And now these extra fill-in notes we heard a little bit last episode when we talked about number 3, but the dotted rhythm is something we haven't yet talked about. And now the other entrances are different from the bass entrance.
Yeah, let's listen to the soprano entrance now. So, a couple of differences here. One, very obvious one, it's upside down.
And there's one other difference as well, isn't there?
Exactly. The soprano is not only upside down, it's also twice as fast as the bass. So I will play for you the bass and the soprano against each other, and you will notice that. Started later than the bass, interrupting it, which is very impolite for a fugue. Usually the voice who started gets to finish its entrance first, but here we have the soprano interrupting the bass, and I'm going to ask Sam to...
So that is another piece of jargon we call, because of these interruptions, which will happen throughout this fugue as well, we call it a stretto fugue. That's when the entrances are layered on top of each other, happening simultaneously. And these different versions of the subject are omnipresent kind of throughout this fugue, right side up, upside down, fast and slow, and in all different combinations. So why don't you show us maybe one other place where this happens?
So let's see. There is a wonderful place towards the end of the fugue where we'll have 3 voices simultaneously presenting the subject, almost simultaneously, interrupting each other. 2 of them will be at the faster pace, and 1, the soprano, will be at the original slow pace. So the tenor starts first, and it will start on this note, and then the soprano will start second, and it will start on this note, and then...
Soprano a little slower.
That's the slower one, exactly. And then we have the alto coming in last on this note. So I'll try
right
to play
side up the alto
right
as
side
well.
Up. Yeah, the tenor, the fast voices are right side up. The slow voice is upside down.
So why don't you play those 3 voices for us first, and then we'll add the bass voice to hear
how
it all sounds together.
Okay, so let me try.
Together with the bass voice as well.
Sure.
And with all the other voices adding their different commentaries too.
Mm-hmm.
very exciting. And what I love so much about this section, and very characteristic for Bach, in fact, especially in the Art of Fugue, is how we have the different voices hinting at different keys even while they're playing together. So the tenor voice is hinting at F major.
Mm-hmm.
So play that one more time.
Because it starts on F.
Nice and sunny,
mm-hmm.
whereas then when the soprano comes in, very clearly we're back in D minor.
And that key is being supported then by the alto as well. So he really changes gears halfway.
Changes gears halfway, and in addition, you heard not only the changing gears in terms of the key, but also at the very beginning of what you were playing, we had this constant run of 16th notes, and while the tenor was playing its subject, we completely changed gears away from that as well, didn't we?
Yeah, it's the constant stream of 16s really makes us feel like we're playing in a faster tempo, which we really aren't. We're playing at the same tempo the fugue started in, and the constant stream of 16s is really a couple of stretto 16th groups stuck to each other. You know, usually we hear the 16th in groups of four, and now we hear several groups of four stuck to each other, and that
pushing
really
us forward
makes for
yeah.
this you know, almost illusion that we are at a faster pace. And then the music halts midway,
and this
and
is very characteristic of something that we haven't even gotten to quite yet in talking about this fugue, perhaps the most interesting aspect of all,
that
which is this signature rhythmic characteristic, rhythmic style.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, this fugue is tends to be labeled as a fugue in the French style. And what is meant is the style of the French overture, which was a 17th century style created in France, inspired by dance and drama, basically to precede operas and big shows in France. And the German composers, and specifically Bach, of the late 17th and early 18th century, really loved that genre and turned it into a real art piece. They turned it into an instrumental artwork.
So what in this piece specifically is characteristic of that style?
The dotted rhythms, which we spoke about at the beginning, you know.
Especially the fast
this.
Ones toward the end of the theme. Play those one more
yeah.
time.
France was called playing inégal, which means unequally, and very often the notes would be written as equal eighth notes, but the performers would play them unequally to give them that swing. It's almost like swing in jazz, where you swing notes the way it feels right. Now, in Bach's case, they are already notated as dotted rhythms, so they become more specific that way.
And then there's one other rhythmic gesture as well, which occurs throughout this fugue that you already heard,
yeah,
and that is...
We have runs of 4/16ths and or runs of 4/32ths, which are also a stretto of each other in a way. You know, one is twice as fast as the other. So they are almost like flourishes, or like, you know, you can see a gesture behind them, and they tend to release the tension that builds up from the constant dotted rhythm.
Right,
so
we always get this halting feeling from after this rush of 32nds.
Exactly, so suspense, yeah. You see how well they work against each other, the dotted rhythm and the runs. And Bach's using the French overture style for writing a fugue, a four-voice fugue, a complex fugue, you know, stretto fugue and a counter fugue, is a pretty audacious idea, and he makes it work. And he's probably one of the only composers, or very few, who can really make that work.
I'd say probably the only.
The only.
However, it was not uncommon for Bach, of course, to use the French style. That was kind of a favorite technique of his, this genre.
Yeah, he really must have liked it a lot, and other composers like Handel and Telemann used it a lot, because it's a very characteristic pace for a piece. And if you listen to the orchestral suites of Bach, for example, the second one, it starts with a French overture. He used it in some of his cantatas.
And also... If you're familiar with the Goldberg Variations, there is a French overture in that piece as well. Why don't I play just a little bit of that so you can hear how it has the same feeling with these runs of quick scale notes and dotted rhythms as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you can hear how these characteristic rhythmic gestures give it this pompous feeling, and I think that's suggestive of the courtly tradition and the necessity
wife, the
for spectatorship.
Music making exactly, and just, you know, the show aspect of what, you know, what was the music performance in the 18th century. So although Bach wasn't a court composer while composing the Art of Fugue, he had been a court composer preceding his time in Leipzig in the court of Köthen. And so he had seen a lot of that and actually liked it very much. So I think when he wrote music, he never meant for music to not be performed. And
a lot of people say about the Art of Fugue, oh, it's very abstract, it's not really a performance piece, it doesn't work well in concert.
And I really, yes, it's a difficult piece to make work in concert, you know, it has certain challenges, but I think the presence of a French overture, inspired fugue in there, for me, is one of those direct proofs that makes me think that's music meant to be heard and meant to be exciting. It's not just about it being extremely well constructed polyphonically.
And another criticism that people levy against the Art of Fugue, as a performance piece at least, is the supposed monotony of all these pieces being D minor. But I think this fugue, as well as all the others, but especially this one, is a great rebuttal to that claim.
Well, they all have very specific characters, and they all get progressively more and more rich harmonically, and in some ways less settled. The harmony gets a lot of...
We move around to lots and lots of different keys without ever having this feeling of groundedness. In other words, we're always shifting around, but in a sense, never leaving D minor at the same time, which is this remarkable feeling that I think Bach was the only one, I think, who was capable of.
Because I think he was really unique in combining the 17th century way of constructing harmony, which was through polyphony, and the 18th century way of creating harmony, which was more through premeditated ideas of where you're going
direction.
To end up. And so combining direction with inevitability is pretty interesting.
And he managed to insert into that a much more 19th century feeling that I think we hear increasingly in the works of Wagner, Liszt, Brahms, which was more adventurous, which I think the Art of Fugue was way ahead of its time in terms of that adventurousness.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're very much looking forward to hearing this piece again, with Ralitza playing the piano this time. In our performance, we've decided to play on three different instruments, piano, harpsichord, and organ. And it's been very interesting to decide which ones to play on which instrument, and we actually have a cordial difference of opinion on some of these matters. I particularly love the way you play it on piano. Your playing has this incredible sense of articulation and drive without ever being the least bit overbearing. Ralitza has a different idea.
Well, I've chosen the harpsichord partly because it is the instrument that inspired the gestures of the French style.
And of course, the piano was not really existing yet.
Present
definitely
in
not
its
in its modern
form. Yes, we have
at the time of this piece.
We have been told that Bach did try the piano, but it was a very,
very different
instrument, and much more similar to the harpsichord, with the only difference that the harpsichord sound is being produced by plucking the string, and the piano or fortepiano sound was being produced by a hammer hitting the string.
And this, of course, allows for a more immediate, direct control over the volume of the sound on the piano, which is one advantage, but at the same time, there are certain disadvantages, of course.
Well, I think the harpsichord definitely has advantages over the piano in clarity of the registers, which enables us to really hear all the voices at the same time and not have to make choices and hide certain voices and then bring out others.
In other words, you don't have to try as hard to bring clarity to the music on the harpsichord as on the piano.
Exactly. You hear the mixture, but you also hear the individuality of the voices, whereas on the piano they really tend to mix better with each other, but the individuality is rather has to be helped. Another difference that works very well on the harpsichord is the clarity of the articulation. Anything you do with articulation on the harpsichord comes out immediately, whether you play the notes connected to each other, whether you play them detached, disconnected from each other, and the way you make those choices actually influences the rhythmical picture of the music, and it gives it a certain swing. That can also be used at the piano, but again, we have to modify it due to the longer time it takes the hammer to swing and hit the string, and you know, there are certain things that the piano, with its behemoth quality, from which we get this velvety sound and this richness of overtones and you know, sustaining power and dynamic control. However, articulation and clarity are things that we have to fight for on the piano, and on the harpsichord, they come up naturally.
And you've talked a little bit also about how you have to monitor your timing more carefully on the piano, whereas on the harpsichord you have a little bit more freedom.
Well, I think one is inspired to use controlled rhythmical freedom on the harpsichord because it enriches, it kind of compensates for the lack of dynamic
possibilities.
But the interesting thing is that rhythmic freedom actually helps some of our piano playing too. So
you've taken much of what you've learned from the harpsichord and transferred it to piano.
Yeah.
So we're very happy to hear you play it again on piano, and it was great to have you as well on the podcast. Thanks.
Thank you. It was a big pleasure, and I'll enjoy listening to your upcoming podcasts.
So here it is now, Contrapuntis 6 from the Art of Fugue with Ralitza Acheva on piano. Thank you. Much for playing. That is some very intense music, mm-hmm. and I have to say, well, I said earlier, some of these later fugues become kind of a little overwhelming, and I mean that in the best way possible. It just comes at you, and it doesn't really stop.
It does. It does. That's
brilliant playing again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Music Post. You can find out more about this podcast at www.samueljpost.com/podcast, and it will be available in the iTunes store for subscription very soon. Thanks for listening again. I hope you'll join me next time.
Thank you.